is or was the concept of evil. Now, what I really wish to do in the context of what is going on here at Holden Village, where there seems to be a series of specialists in various areas, geology, theology, youth research, and so on, pooling their resources, what I wish to do is to report, in a sense, on some recent discussions in philosophy on morality, not only on the concept evil, but obviously also on its correlative concept, goodness. And I want to, I suppose, start out in a negative way by saying what I'm not going to discuss, because not being a theologian, I don't care to get involved in what is sometimes called the problem of evil, namely, how if God is both omniscient and, omnipotent and loving, we still have what some people consider to be evil in the world. Rather, what I wish to look at are certain, as I said, moral terms like good and evil, right and wrong, and whatnot. Second, and what I in a way consider even a more important qualification, is you will not receive from me a catalog of what I take to be evil. It seems to me that that would be neither interesting for you nor really pertinent to what is going on, at least in philosophy or perhaps in theology or anywhere. I mean, I think it would be easy enough for any of us or all of us to just sit down and start giving a catalog, a list of what we take, you know, to be evil, to be wrong with the world, and very quickly we'd find harsh clashes in these catalogs. I mean, they would be really at loggerheads, really up against each other. Just before I left to come to Holden, I happened to be browsing through a magazine, a news commentary type magazine, and that particular issue just somehow seemed to me, again, to have every article detailing something that was horribly wrong with the world. And I came away from my home on the way to Holden completely, in a sense, weighed down with this sense of frustration or of evil. But the really serious problem, to which I've already alluded now, which gives impetus to my topic, is the fact that we don't agree, all of us, in our moral judgments. I mean, if, as I said, I were to give a catalog of what I take to be evil, I suspect that I could find someone to disagree with me at each point. And there are a lot of other examples I'm sure that you can all come up with. One that particularly hit home to me just in the last day or two here at the village is that I was asked to help out Jerry while he went on a hike and play for the singing at meals and stuff like that. And so, being totally unfamiliar with the Holden milieu and its music and rhythm and whatnot, and thinking that it was good if I caught up on this, and you notice the word good slipping in here already, I went over to the dining hall, got out the music, and ran through it one morning between breakfast and lunch. And that was yesterday. When I came to lunch to play for the dinner, here was a huge, I might add, anonymous sign on a piano that says, "Please do not use this piano between mealtimes." And I spent, I mean, so there again, the words good and bad weren't even used, but the what I took to be good, obviously somebody else took to be rather grossly evil. So, and even after spending some 10 minutes trying to find out the source of the sign, futilely I might add, I just decided that that was life. But in other words, we don't agree on what is good or evil or on what we ought to do or ought not do. But yet, as we are reminded when we sing our songs or we look at the mountains or whatever, we do seem to share a common world. And in many areas, if we have a factual disagreement, we can find methods of solving it. I mean, if, for example, Joel would disagree with the results that were just being talked about in terms of youth research and whatnot, he has certain methods at his disposal in the discipline of sociology in which he can go and do his own work, take his own samples, get his own results, his own data, and see whether or not it agrees. And if it doesn't agree, then they can start looking for reasons why it doesn't agree, and on and on. I mean, it gets very complex and involved, but the methods at least are there if somebody wants to take the time and effort to do it. Or again, if Larry Collins is going to tell us, for instance, that granite is harder than limestone, and somebody disagrees, Larry has methods for showing or proving whatnot in terms of scratching and this type of stuff, that what he said is correct, and hopefully can get some sort of agreement on that. Or again, if there's a disagreement about whether or not Holden Village is situated above 5,000 feet from sea level. Again, there are ways of solving it, and so on and so on. But a very serious issue is how, if at all, can we settle a moral dispute? One man says the war in Vietnam is good, another man says it's evil. Is there anything, when we come to use these terms, any method at our disposal? And this problem, of course, has even entered theology, and not just philosophy, in the guise of so-called situation ethics, where if you're asked the question, what ought I do, or if someone makes an evaluation, he did the wrong thing, he really ought not have done that, or he violated his obligation, or he forsook his duty, or whatever, and you say, well, how do you know, or how can you advise me, what do I appeal to, what's the basis of my obligation, or my responsibility, you get a very wide spread of opinion. Some people will say, just look at the Ten Commandments. If you can follow those, you're all set. Others will go to the completely other extreme of the spectrum and say, about all I can tell you is to love your neighbor as yourself, you know, and you've got to take it from there and live creatively, and so on. And, you know, that if you get law, if you get form and so on in here, you're just going to get boxed in and you won't be able to fulfill your responsibility to other people. And if you set these two groups of people next to each other and try and get them to discuss, it seems to me the very serious question that arises, not only in terms of just who's right, is how do we find out who's right, which seems to me to be a prior question before we can even come down and say, well, he's right and they're wrong. We have to have some method for working that out. Now, it seems to me, at least, that in order to get at the problem of whether agreement on values is even possible, it's necessary to examine moral discourse. Because, as Paul Hayne reminded us last week, it is imperative that we speak to each other. I mean, there's a lot of talk in our day about dialogue and whatnot, but, I mean, this is where our hang-ups initially begin, is with the moral language we use. Now, last week, again, at one point in a very engaging and exciting discussion, I heard the following remark with which I couldn't disagree more. Namely, someone used a particular word and was challenged, and in order to get on with what he wanted to say, just sort of said over his shoulder, put any word you want in there, I don't care. And it seems to me this type of carelessness is really very dangerous, that at least personally, I do care what words people are using and how they're using them, because this is the beginning of our problem, it seems to me. So I don't then want to discuss what is evil in the sense of giving this catalog I talked about, but if I may play with words, what I want to discuss is what evil is, and to at least begin with that by discussing what the word evil means, that is, what it is we might be talking about. Now, in order to do that, I have to introduce, for better or worse, a couple of technical notions. At least in philosophy, they turn out to be technical, although they are also, again, a part of everyday language, and words that themselves are a source of difficulty. I wish just to stipulate, in the sense now that I'm reporting on a certain group of philosophers, which we'll just call philosophers A, to avoid labels like realist, pragmatist, idealist, positivist, and so on. Philosophers A stipulate certain meanings for these terms. And the three terms that are at stake are, first of all, truth, meaning, and definition. Now, truth, according to our group of philosophers, A, is a property, if you wish, of a thought or a sentence. I mean, some thoughts are true and other thoughts are false. And if we happen to give expression to these thoughts in sentences, English or German or Russian or whatever type of sentences, then the sentences themselves will be true or false, depending on whether or not they express true or false thoughts. Now, what makes a sentence true or a thought, I prefer, incidentally, just to speak in terms of language from this point on, because it's a lot easier and quicker and save us all time. But what makes a sentence true, according to these people, is that it corresponds to the way the world is, to certain facts. I mean, if I say, for example, we are now gathered in Koinonia to have our lecture, that is just false. The reason being that the predicate I have employed there, Koinonia, does not apply to this room. In other words, the sentence does not fit the world, so to speak. There's a disparity, and so the sentence is false. And further, these people want to say that a sentence is either true or false and not both. Now, this is a highly debatable assumption, but since I didn't want to just do a series of lectures on logic, I'd again just want to lay it down as one of my premises, which in the discussion, if you want to come back and undermine, you're welcome to. But there again are problems with this notion that a sentence is either true or false and not both. I mean, suppose I say something like, if it rains, I'll meet you in a village center, but if it doesn't rain, I'll meet you at the new sauna and we'll go on a hike up Copper Falls, and it drizzles. I mean, you know, at that point, somebody might say, well, you know, the sentence is really neither, I mean, the statement that I made, if it rains, I'll meet you in the village, in a certain room, that really is neither true nor false, perhaps, because of this complete vagueness. You really don't know if it's raining or not raining. Now, here it seems to me the problem is just with vagueness. I mean, if you want to be real pedantic and precise and clear up what you mean by rain in terms of a meteorologist's rain gauge or something and say if it's above so many thousandths of an inch, it's rain, and if it isn't, it's not, so on, that's fine. But, or again, take a sentence like, Caesar's grandfather had a wart on his nose. Now, it seems to me that this sentence is one that's either true or false. I mean, either he had the wart or he didn't. The problem with it historically, or philosophically really, is probably no problem historically, but the problem is that historians, thank goodness, weren't recording such bits of trivia, and so we don't have any way of finding out whether or not Caesar's grandfather had a wart on his nose. In other words, we don't know whether the sentence is true or false, but at least I would maintain that it is one or the other, that our knowing it or not knowing it is irrelevant to its status. And insofar, I would agree with this group of philosophers that we're just calling A. Now, in terms of meaning, we really have a two prongs here. First of all, we can talk about the meanings of words, and then second, we can talk about the meanings of sentences in which these words occur. And our group, again, says that the meaning of a word is that entity to which it refers. In other words, the word green means the color of this chalkboard. The word orange means the color of that cushion, and so on. These words get their meaning purely arbitrarily. I mean, obviously, German-speaking people don't use G-R-E-E-N to mean this color. They have picked arbitrarily a different set of symbols and apply that. But the meaning of both of the symbols, the German word, the German equivalent of the English word green, and the English word green, get their meaning by being applied to a certain thing in the world. Now, thing there is being used in the broadest and vaguest possible sense. Maybe entity or something would be better, because the word thing has been preempted in phrases like do your thing or don't thingify or something. But here we can be talking about entity in the broadest possible sense. I mean, a characteristic like green, or a thing, an entity like a chair, or a process like evolution or something of that sort. Words get their meanings by being applied to things. And if there's nothing to which the word can be taken to apply, then supposedly it's meaningless. Now, similarly, a sentence, then, has to have meaningful words in it, and secondly, has to be constructed according to certain rules which the grammarians tell us about. And if we take a sentence like, John strawberries nor, period, each of the words in it is probably meaningful. I mean, we can devise a context or point to an entity or a kind of entity, a type of fruit, for example, which carries the meaning or accounts for the meaning of that phrase. But the sentence itself, John strawberries nor, technically isn't even a sentence. I mean, it just lacks meaning. Nothing comes across. So that's a case in which we have a sentence in which the words are meaningful, but the sentence structure, the order, the form, whatever you want to call it, is lacking. On the other hand, if we take a sentence like the following, which we'll use at some length this morning, namely, Bamfy is a pample. Here we have a case where we have something that looks perfectly good according to English grammar. You've got a subject, you've got the copula, indefinite article, and some sort of predicate. In other words, you're saying something about some entity called Bamfy. Not to be confused with Bambi of the nursery rhymes and so on. But again, until you know what this word refers to, and until you know what type of predicate this word refers to, nothing comes across. I mean, this sentence is literally meaningless. Because the words have not gotten a conventional application. Now finally, our third concept to get at this business of evil then is definition, which is treated by the people I'm reporting on this morning again as merely an abbreviation, a list of parts, if you wish. I mean, if you want to give a definition of the word horse, one thing at least you can do is to list the various parts of a horse, and the biologist supposedly can give a very exhaustive and elaborate list of parts. And if you want to go on, perhaps you can list functions. I mean, the economist might come along and define horse in a quite different way. But here again, he's listing certain parts that go to make up this entire entity. Well, with those at our disposal, then, we can move on to the concept of evil and also the concept of goodness. And the philosophers, A, are saying, in effect, that if words and sentences don't fit the explications I've just given, they literally are meaningless. For example, like Bamfi is a pample. Or again, if you, for another example, take something like quadruplicity drinks procrastination. And here again, we have both meaningful words and a good word order. I suppose perhaps I left something out previously. But again, nothing comes through. The way in which these words are put together does not carry any English meaning. They're quite meaningless. But on the other hand, if a sentence is meaningful, then we are somehow talking about the world, and if further that sentence is true, the world is the way the sentence says it is. Consider the sentence, "The apple is red," which is about a certain piece of fruit and one of its properties, its color. Now, if a dispute should arise, it seems to me that we can imagine ways to settle it, as I already said before. But consider a parallel sentence. Suppose I were to say, "This is a good apple," or "This apple is good," if you want the literally same grammatical structure. "This apple is red, this apple is good." The question that these philosophers raise is, am I still talking about the apple or not? In other words, when in the second sentence, I've got something again that looks grammatically just like the first one, when I said the apple was red. But is goodness, or if, I mean, we can turn it around if you want to take the other concept. Suppose I said this is a bad apple. There again, what exactly are we talking about? Or to put it in an even perhaps more sterile formulation, what in that sentence does the word good refer to? Is there something in or about the apple which that word designates? I mean, with the word red, there doesn't seem to be too much of a problem. But people all of a sudden get disturbed and bothered about this sentence, a sentence like, "This apple is good." Do we perhaps, these men want to suggest, really have two sentences going here? Something like, "This is an apple," and "I like this." Now that obviously, that second sentence, doesn't say anything about the apple directly. It says something about me, my feelings, my attitudes, etc. But here now we've come up with a word describing a certain attitude that I have or a certain relationship in which I stand to this apple, which does have meaning and which can be either verified or falsified. I mean, at least I can, by introspection, check out, and I suppose the psychologist, by very carefully scrutinizing my behavior, could arrive at a very plausible conclusion as to whether or not I do like this particular entity. Or again, consider another concrete, if even simple-minded, example. Suppose a father in a family comes home from the Buick garage with his new car and announces to everyone that he's really bought a good car. And his teenage son, who just drove up in the driveway in his jalopy, gets out and carefully scrutinizes the new Buick and immediately labels it a pile of junk or a bad car, if you want to stick with just the phrases. And he and the father get into a real heated argument about not only whether or not the Buick is a good car, but finally the father in self-defense starts attacking the jalopy, and they get into an argument about whether or not the jalopy is a good car. Now here again, our question remains, how, if at all, do you settle this? Now one thing they might do is to give a list of criteria, to start giving reasons. Here's the first step in a moral argument. I mean, they don't just stand there shouting at each other or beating each other over the head, one of them saying, "It's a good car," the other one saying, "It's a bad car." But pretty soon one of them will say, for instance, the father will say, "Well, my new car is good because it has a very comfortable ride, whereas your jalopy just bounces along and rattles your bones." Or again, the father will say, my car is good because I can get six hefty adults in it without any crowding, and all you can get is two or three people in your jalopy. And on and on and on, when the son will come back and say, but I've got fantastic acceleration, you know, I can leave you behind at any stoplight. I can corner much better, and it's a lot louder. And that's what makes a good car. Now here, definitely, we have reasons given for the value judgments that were taken. But if we go that far, it seems to me we're still pushed one level further, namely, how, if at all, can the father and the son give reasons for their reasons, if you want to make it sound paradoxical. How can they justify their reasons? It seems to be purely arbitrary, in a sense, to say, well, a good car is one that is loud, fast, and corners well. And just as arbitrary to say, well, a good car is one that rides smoothly, carries a lot of people, and so on. If this seems like a somewhat trivial issue, you can take it down to an area where we start talking, say, about a good man. I mean, we do use words in this way. He's a good man or he's not a good man. He's the village drunkard or something. But what exactly do or don't we mean? I mean, at this point now, we perhaps reach a sort of tangent with theology, because Christianity, at least, claims to have one position among many as to what it is to be a good man. Theologians talk about proper humanness, you know, and that this is revealed in the example of Christ, appropriately interpreted. Not that you should be perhaps like Kierkegaard and literally live like Christ, you know, not getting married and living in poverty and being persecuted and all this sort of stuff, but at least there are certain relevant features, if not all the features, of the life of Christ which show you what it is to be a human being, what it is to be a good man. And if you just employ these, that's humanness, that's proper humanness, not just any kind of humanness. But of course there are other standards, as we, I'm sure, are well aware, competing with this. In many circumstances, say in a business world, it might be the case that the good man is not the one who is compassionate. Judged from the whole set of criteria, standards, the whole context of a profit-producing corporation. I mean, he might be the one who is bounced out on his ear. He's not the man, he's not the right man for the job, he's not a good man here, and so on. But if you ask them why not, and if you say, well, look, here's the New Testament, you know, here's the example of Christ, and look how he acted in that situation, somewhat like some of us think Christ would have acted. It could be that the president and chairman of the board will say, that's right, but unfortunately it's not what we want in this situation. So he's not the right man for the job. He's not a good man. Let him go become a pastor or something. But, what I'm getting at is here we still have this type of dispute, this violent disagreement about what it is to be a human being. And eventually it seems to the group of philosophers, A, that what we are really doing is merely expressing our emotions or our feelings or our preferences, for which eventually there is no further reason that can be given. But then the problem that arises, and this seems to me a very serious problem, is that there would be no consensus, or perhaps not even any possibility for significant agreement or disagreement about moral issues. In other words, all you can do if somebody disagrees with you in this situation, if you say that values just express our feelings and emotions, is either to try and manipulate him by something like brainwashing so he'll eventually feel like you feel, or to beat him over the head, or something of that sort. But you can't sit down with him and start talking to him because you're not using words the same way. And it'd be like two men arguing, one saying, I have a toothache, and the other man saying, no, you don't, because I have a pain in my big toe. There's no significant disagreement there. They supposedly can both be right. And if the father and the son come up and the father says, this is a good car, by which he means, I like this. And the son comes up and says, this is a bad car, and he means, I detest that. Or even if you want to put it in a logically rigorous form, and the father says, this is a good car, and the son says, this is not a good car. On this view, it would appear that there's really no disagreement going on, any more than the guy who said, I have a toothache, and the man who disagreed and said, no, you don't, because I have a pain in my big toe. And this, it seems to me at least, is, well, almost an, in a way, intolerable conclusion, at least if one is to take other facets of our language seriously. I mean, I start out by saying that if we have a dispute that is factual or whatever you want to call it, scientific, empirical, or whatnot, I mean, if someone says, this room is called koinonia, and somebody says this room is not called koinonia, there are ways of settling it. They're really saying something. They're not just talking about their feelings, their reactions. They're saying a sentences that are true or false. Now, I might just go on briefly to point out that the same group of philosophers have also mounted an analogous attack on religious language. Because what they've said about ethical language, although I didn't use the jargon exactly, is that it's meaningless. It doesn't refer to anything out there in the world in the way in which words like chair and red and horse and so on refer to something that you can get at, something, if you want to use these words, tangible or capable of being experienced. And a similar thing has been said about concepts like God, or even on by these people about the use of analogy in trying to give some meaning to the concept of God. Because these men, being empirically oriented, want to insist on evidence, on reference. In other words, the words, in order to be meaningful, have to refer to something. Now, even in the case of what appear initially in our language to be intangible words like love and brotherhood, our group of philosophers, A, would say that these have a definite meaning. I mean, in a social context, these words have meaning in English, and you can find out what that is by, for instance, observing behavior. I mean, if somebody says, my wife loves me, or if I say that, there are ways of finding that out, other than by just asking her to introspect and find out whether or not there's a certain mental characteristic there which we call love, and that it's on this morning or something. I mean, all you have to do is observe certain forms of behavior, certain forms of speech and whatnot. But the same people would say there really is not much, if any, evidence for a claim like there is a God and he loves us. Because right away, the question would be asked, what does the word God refer to? Or in the context of a sentence in which the word God is the subject, what does the predicate love refer to? I mean, I know what the word love means when I say my wife loves me or my children don't love me or something. But what does it mean when I use this other word? And there are many of them who have said the word God has for them, at least, exactly the same amount of content or meaning as the word Bamfi does for us. And so that when somebody comes up to them and says, God is love, it would be like if I walked up to you and said, Bamfi is a pample. And further, I'd like you to come and join him in our ritual, our Bamfi ritual over here. But here again, the claim is based primarily on evidence. A parable is told by one of these men about two hunters who were in a jungle. And they came across a clearing in which there were some flowers. Could very well have been wildflowers growing. But one of the hunters got it in his head that there must have been a gardener who came to tend that plot, that clearing, because here were flowers and the trees were gone and all this sort of thing. And the other guy, whom we could call the skeptic, was convinced there were no flowers. There was no gardener there. And so they decided, again, by means of the methods I've already alluded to solve the issue, to settle the question once and for all. And the first thing they did was just set up a watch every 4 hours. They took turns taking watch. They set up a little tree house off the clearing, and they started watching. And they made sure that somebody was looking at the clearing all the time of the two of them. And after about a week of this, nobody had been spotted coming in to tend this little clearing. So the believer immediately said, well, perhaps the gardener is invisible. And the skeptic, for better or worse, was willing to go along with that. So I'm not sure. This isn't supposed to be discussed, I guess. But they set up an electric fence, and they began patrolling it with bloodhounds. And no movement of the fence ever indicated that somebody was climbing over to get into the clearing, and nobody ever screamed, or they never heard any screams indicating that somebody had bumped into the fence, and the bloodhounds never gave any cry whatsoever. They just placidly plodded along the fence. And a skeptic then put it to him and said, well, no gardener. We've tried all various types of evidence. tactual and visual and auditory and olfactory. The dogs don't smell anything and so on. There's no gardener who comes here. But the believer was very insistent and said, but maybe it's a gardener who comes here every day who's invisible, intangible, insensitive to electric shock, odor-free, and so on. And he comes, attends this plot, and goes away at night. At which point, the skeptic raised the question, which in a sense becomes the punchline, what difference is there between an intangible, invisible, odor-free gardener and no gardener at all? Now, the interpretation of that parable runs something like this then. And here again, I'm drawing heavily on their example, but it makes a point, even if somewhat gruesomely. The man who wrote the parable goes on to say then, but consider in an analogous situation what happens when people start talking about God, and they start talking about concrete everyday situations. And the situation he comes up with is a 2-year-old child dying of inoperable cancer. And he says, suppose this situation arises, and the preacher tells the father, God loves his people as a father loves his children. And we, observing the situation, see the earthly father driven to distraction in attempts to get some sort of cure or help for his child. But again, in this purely in terms of evidence, no evidence is ever brought forward to indicate that the heavenly father gives two hoots. And it's this type of interpretation of the parable that gives rise to the question, what meaning do we have or can we assign to words like God and love when they occur in a sentence like God loves his people as a father loves his children? I mean, if the word love at this point seems to have been stretched so far to cover a relationship in which it was not originally concocted, as the word originally applied to our human situation, that it seems to lose all meaning. Now here again, recall what I said at the outset, that I am a philosopher and not a theologian, and look at these issues from a philosopher's perspective, which is to say a perspective that stands outside revelation, which is itself a very serious problem of knowledge for philosophers. But the real question is, what can words, either theological, and this in a sense is a digression from my topic this morning, but what can words, theological or ethical, what meaning can they have if there is nothing to which they either apparently or actually refer, if they don't get at anything? And you recall again, this is one of the assumptions we started with, that words get their meaning by being applied to something. Now to come back and wind up so we can have some discussion this business, it seems that the crucial problem that our group of philosophers A set up is that there seems to be nothing in the world outside of man to which moral terms refer, in the way in which there might be something in the world to which words like red and green and square and horse and so on refer. And thus, by this account of meaning, these words lack meaning. They are meaningless. But the problem with this, then, is if these terms only express feelings, they function approximately like the cheerleader's hurrah. Namely, first of all, to express my own emotion, to give vent to my own feelings, and second, to try and evoke the same feeling in other people, which is the function of the cheerleader as she goes back and forth in front of the crowd, cheering and shouting and expressing her own emotion, trying to evoke the same emotion in others. But if somebody in the stands picking this up were to start shouting hurrah, or the team just made a touchdown and people are standing up and down, screaming and hollering, clapping each other on the back, it would seem, according to these people, to be really bizarre to turn to that person and ask either of two questions. What does that mean, or is that right, or is that true? In other words, that ethical language just doesn't function that way. That the disagreement is not, so to speak, an objective one. But as I said, the result of this then is that significant rational dispute is impossible, and we're reduced to trying to manipulate or bludgeon the other person to get him to have a feeling like ours. So the dilemma we're left with here, although it appears to arise from certain facts of our human experience, is that moral terms like good and evil are either meaningless or hopelessly relative. That is, that there are no real moral disputes but only apparent ones, sort of like tastes, you know, about pizza or cigarettes or something. about which the proverb says, you know, there's no disputing. So I think I will, since it's 10 o'clock, almost 10, arbitrarily break off at this point and open it up for discussion. There are a couple of questions I might just throw in here to sort of focus the discussion. First of all, perhaps the most obvious one, what do you think of this view? And second, how, if at all, can it be answered? A third question that I came up with just as I was going off to sleep last night was, in a way, perhaps the most serious question with this whole issue, and that is, do we often really try to resolve moral disputes? I mean, once a man starts talking about the fact that significant moral disputes are really impossible, and we get all excited and say, well, look, I'm constantly involved in bull sessions and discussions, and I argue about the war, and I argue about this and all these things. But do we ever really try to resolve these, or are we just content with, you know, throwing out our opinions, that is, giving vent to our emotions and then letting it go with that? But the problem that I would like to pursue in the discussion now and then also on Thursday is whether or not moral disputes are significant, meaningful, and secondly, if they are, how we can resolve them. No, stop talking. Yeah. But suppose, again, to try and stick with a simple-minded case, I suppose I were to hold this up and say, this cup is red and white for me, and somebody else were to come up and say, no, if you want to discuss it at all, you've got to say that the color of this cup is something like, I don't have anything handy, well, the color of this cup is roughly like the shade of this advertisement right here, that shade plus white, that's all that's there in that cup. And that's the way it is for me. In other words, as we would commonly speak, that man is colorblind. It would seem very bizarre for me just to say, well, I can't even talk to you, you know, because we don't even live in the same world. I mean, you live in a gray-white world, and I live in a red-white world, and red-whites and gray-whites are just, you know, hopelessly lost. Or again, let me put it this way. In the case of what I have here labeled significant disputes, we don't start with your type of premise. I mean,
Did you read this article in Time some weeks ago about this man is advocating eliminating the word is?
Yeah.
It gets into some very interesting ramifications. And here again, I don't think it's so much the word good or bad or evil or what as it is the word is.
The word
is, I ask.
I counted how many times the author used the word is in writing the article.
Well, that seems to me, of course, again, this is just my bias and it would take a long time to argue for, but it seems to me that that in a way is if not impossible, an extremely difficult undertaking to follow through. I mean, the position underlying it is the notion that relations are much more important than properties. And that if you want to talk about the world, what you have to talk about are just relationships or processes, but not, so to speak, static properties. I mean, it makes no sense to say, this is red, but if you want to eliminate red, you'd go to things like saying, this has the same color as that, or which expresses a relationship of similarity, or this appears red to me, or something of that sort, which means it stands in a certain relationship to me, and everything with that proposal becomes, it seems to me, exceptionally relative. I mean, based on the notion of relations, of similarity, of perception, or whatnot. Let's see, Henry.
Would this analogy we have for this situation is, it seems to me that so much of our talk depends on a particular frame of reference. Say, suppose that you and I went to a concert and heard this marvelous violinist, and I, being, and you being musically inclined, was just thrilled at the music that was coming out of this violinist. And I, perhaps in my scientific sense, would be wondering what kind of capture the violinist things were being made to produce the music. And so both of us would be right, depending upon our frame of reference. And so
okay.
Much,
yeah.
The philosophic interpretation is dependent upon our particular frame of reference on which we would exercise our judgment on.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's a very good way to phrase it. The question that, in effect, I'm raising here then, by using these men as a foil or a backdrop, is whether or not there is anything that we might call a common frame of reference. I mean, since I've come to the village on Thursday, one of the phrases I've heard most often is common humanity, which seems to militate against the notion of separate frames of reference, at least in certain crucial areas, supposedly ethical, if not aesthetic, and other things. And I begin to wonder, personally, I mean, and I think this is a point that ought to be discussed at some length, whether or not the notion of common humanity might not be as big a myth as the notion of being created equal. I mean, it's perhaps a faith statement, or it's a notion of a goal to be achieved, or something to work at. As Paul Hayne put it last week, we have to think again and talk again, or look again, and so on. I mean, there is some effort involved in trying to get together with people, but is it ever really possible?
I have a question pertaining to the framework in which you set the problem and also discussed it.
Good.
You have just used here a set of philosophers that you call A, and I can gather that this is relativism, pragmatism, probably something about analytic positivism and so on. How about other systems, B, C, D, and so on, those that deal with metaphysics and with ontology?
Sure.
Try to find the essence of things and so on.
Yeah.
There is a variety of philosophic schools in which you can discuss the problem of truth and meaning,
right,
which is quite different. That assumes something real outside of a human being. And I wondered if this is not to be taken as an option always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree.
Of course, it's in positivism, and I realize immediately the color of asking the question and
sure,
not giving the answer. However, there is a possibility of challenging the same problem in a different philosophic setting in which the answers are probably quite clearly and
mm-hmm,
well-defined too.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Tried to be somewhat self-conscious at the beginning that this was being set out mostly as a foil or a way of attacking the problem. And the only, the main rejoinder, it seems to me, that could be given is that the starting point for this whole discussion was at least to a certain extent, a common framework, namely the set of objects of experience that we would at least minimally agree on. Benches and walls and ceilings and buildings and mountains and second, a shared language, which may not be as shared as many people think, but that we do, to some degree or other, manage to express to people what we get at, and scientists, whether they happen to be in Moscow or Washington, can agree on certain pertinent facts about the atom or the moon and this thing. And then the question was raised, can we live with the same assumptions about ethical language that we just have about these other, which I put it, factual remarks. In other words, is there anything common there? And of course, our age, obviously, perhaps this is a one reason for starting with this position, but our age obviously is sort of wallowing in a relativism, whether it's historical or somehow cultural, sociological, or whatever.
Question of ought, which is, we ask, you know, and this ought may be a capitalized ought, you know, it's certain system that is implied, which one would want to see the humanity and civilization move through. And along with it, I am a little bit puzzled here because Paul Heyman, in his presentation, asserted quite vigorously that for a Christian, all of the ethical questions are even nonsense. That our life is rooted so strongly in God that therefore it is in God, and is, or a kind of an existential reality in which you live, that there is no odd question that is proper at this point. And so he said that the real Lutheran doesn't have any need for ethics, and there is no moral question whatever, because it is lived. His life is lived in a real relationship, which where the is and the ought has already sort of been answered. And if what is not done in terms of ought is forgiven, you know, that is taken care of by a heavenly accountant, you know, who just writes it off without any demands upon us.
Well, I suppose my problem at that point would come in with a definition of what you mean, what one would mean by Christian. Then, I mean, if for example, take a situation that's become hackneyed by now, but during the Second World War, and well, this is true. I suppose, well, I don't know about this war or not, but you know, you had the American troops singing "God Bless America" and having American chaplains conducting worship for them before they went into battle. And right on the other side of the line, you had Germans with Gott mit uns on their belt buckles, and the German chaplains having worship for them before they went into battle. And it seems difficult, at least for me, on the surface, and this is something I would like to probe, but to say that all of these people had the same ought or even the same isness or whatever in their situation. I mean, it seems to me that if they would have had in a sense, they just didn't have a common frame of reference. That's why they were there in the first place.
Well, that's the, to me, the hole in this argument, because everything is relative, and unless you're talking on the same level of relativity, you're not really having a distinction. I mean, war, yes, it's pretty black and white, you know, but there are so many other shades of gray other than war.
Yeah, but even, I mean, well, let's back up a step. Even taking the war case, it seems to me that there is a lot of disagreement there. Again, one of the examples that has been pawed over almost endlessly is the atomic bombing of Japan. But suppose that all of the parties, say even in the cabinet, President Truman's cabinet, who were discussing the ought or ought notness of this action, and you might want to say that that's not even a moral discussion, which is a plausible contention, but I mean, suppose they all agreed on the facts and said, if we drop it, then, you know, the war will be shortened by so many weeks. If we drop it, so many people will be killed in the bomb. Our nuclear physicists can give us this quite precisely. But on the other hand, so many soldiers' lives will be saved on the battlefield, and our military men can tell us what that is. I mean, suppose they all agreed on the facts and they had settled all these disputes. It still seems to me plausible that there would have been disagreement on the rightness and wrongness of dropping it, that agreement on the facts wouldn't have necessitated agreement on the moral obligation at that point.
Well, but you see, when you're already committed to a war, when you get to that point, you don't really have any choice.
Yeah.
So you have to backtrack, you know. Was the original commitment to the war morally right?
Did you have your hand up?
I was going
to say
maybe practically, or factually, it might be true. I mean, human beings work that way. But
excuse me.
In principle, or my human nature, what it means to be human, wouldn't permit me to say that. We are not. Thank you.
Oh, that's true, but you see, it wasn't just a question of how should we kill this many people with this bomb. It also involved a question of how many more people will be killed if the war is allowed to continue. Mm-hmm. So you're simply taking the choice of two evils. There isn't any good choice for you.
Right.
And that's what happened when you first committed yourself to the war.
But you do have a choice of evils.
Right.
Yeah.
Lesser of two evils, right. Right. But then the question for me becomes, on what grounds do you make that choice? I mean, you make it on a basis of the law of God, or on a basis of civil law, or on a basis of conscience, or on a basis of certain motives you have, or purely empirically on a basis of consequences, or, I mean, all of these various systems have received their own philosophical or metaphysical embodiment at some time or another. And either actively or sort of, go ahead.
Interesting question too. Some lady back in here was just saying, if two people are having a discussion and one believes in God and one doesn't, you can't, you don't really have any common level meeting. No. Isn't it the same thing true in war? We as Christians feel, know that killing another man is evil. And yet, if you're not dealing with other people with the same set of morals, then what do you do?
Hmm. Yeah, well, I suppose that all of us implicitly assume that a moral judgment ought in some way to be, maybe you don't, I shouldn't have said that, but anyway, I sort of think that a moral judgment should be as general as possible. For those of you to whom this comment has any meaning, I somewhat agree with Immanuel Kant, but and Christianity has this definite virtue, it seems to me, that the source of Christian value definitely transcends something like a given nation, so that a judgment can be given. I mean, we talk about the church having a prophetic role or something of this sort, and saying that there are some standards that are different from and or better than those, say, even of the American Constitution, if you want to be that radical. But on the other hand, there are some people who would say, yes, we definitely need to have a standard that transcends or is more general than the laws of any given society or even any given city or something of that sort, like Martin Luther King was appealing to. The Constitution is more general than the city statutes of Montgomery or something. But the Constitution itself isn't perhaps the ultimate word. There are others who, agreeing with that, would say, well, but to go clear up to God is to go, in a sense, outside the world in which we live. Why don't we just stop with this common humanness? And even at this point, you get somebody like Marx talking, who says, what we really need to do is realize that even the workers are people. They also share in this common humanness. And there must be some sort of human solidarity or something. We need to get our transcendence at this point. I mean, the people in Russia are as much people as the people in America, and the people in Sweden are as much people as the people in Norway, and so on.
It seems to me that, as I try to evaluate this discussion, what we're trying to say is that before any kind of judgment that can be made, we have to come to some sort of basic frame of reference, or as to what we're aiming at, and then seek some sort of consensus up with a basic frame of reference that all of us have come to agree upon. If we're going to have any kind of an intelligent resolution to a given problem.
That's right, but is it conceivable that you could encounter somebody either whose frame of reference you could never be drawn into or whom you could never draw into your frame of reference? And I mean, if that is conceivable, then what do you do? Where do you turn, other than just, like I said, manipulating or bludgeoning?
Well,
or maybe that's all that's left, I don't know.
In that sense, in that particular frame of reference, I would say that you have to recognize that here was a place where no kind of neutral ground would be established until you could accept the fact that you could disagree without being disagreeable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's...
Yeah, well, wouldn't this be a great danger now? This almost serves the vox populi, vox dei. The majority is right. Now, you can have a Powell re-elected by Harlan because they all believe that he is right, the way he lives. And you could almost make, by consensus and by brainwashing and by indoctrinating, all the communist countries, for example, believe that certain things are right, that are communist. They have been taught this way ever since childhood. So I think that that is a rightness that is outside majority, outside it. And I'm actually thinking that Christianity's contribution is this something
right.
that is outside of the majority and the plurality as an overwhelming power.
Oh, my own point here was if a church is for some sort of agreement, then we have to find a common frame of reference. But on the other hand, there are other factors that enter in that may not be able to enable us from the basic frame of reference. And if this is the case, we should recognize this other factor and not think it's impossible.
But you know, Christ was certainly a member of a minority. And very, very little consensus was achieved with a group of his disciples. And in fact, I think the reason why we have so many denominations is because of lack of consensus, even how to interpret scripture. I'm sure we're going to come immediately upon the question, what is demonic and demoniac, or what is evil and capitalized evil? You know, is there such a person somewhere around, you know, that can be theologically defined?
Yeah.
I'm sure that there'll be 350 deviations from any one position.
Right.
Which is the same point as the word beginning, boy in the car. Say, Father, one thing is suddenly said, you really don't, I mean, you express the shock and you're free.
The whole point is, be the car is good or is bad.
Okay. You're back to is. Right, yeah, that's the... I agree with that. There's a common frame of reference. Yeah, if you like tea particularly.